This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont foresters, scientists, and state officials have been scouring the trees for a tiny little beetle with the potential to do a lot of damage. Just one of the several threats to our forests, the emerald ash borer beetle is an invasive little pest that originated in China and was first detected in the U.S. in 2002. Since then, it's been discovered in 19 states, including New York and Massachusetts and the province of Quebec. The ash borer is responsible for the death and decline of tens of millions of ash trees nationwide. It attacks ash trees by boring under their bark and eventually killing the tree by girdling it, making it difficult to get nutrients up the tree. Last week, officials in New Hampshire said they had found an infestation of emerald ash borer in the Concord area, which means Vermonters need to be on the lookout. Many already are. Last year, state officials organized a drill to practice responding when the beetle arrives. Volunteer Jordan Fletcher said citizens like him would be looking for telltale signs, like certain excavations by woodpeckers.
We're also looking for dieback in the canopy or epicormic, a lot of people call them water shoots or water sprouts, coming from the bottom of the tree. And then ultimately what you're looking for is the gallery, you know, these serpentine patterns underneath the bark, because that's the one smoking gun.
Now that the beetle has been spotted right across our border in New Hampshire, it's even more imperative for Vermonters to know the signs and be prepared. We're joined today to find out just how to identify the emerald ash borer by Michael Snyder, Commissioner of Vermont's Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. Welcome to the program, Commissioner.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here with you.
It looks like we have a little issue with your microphone. We'll get that sorted out momentarily. But let me tell listeners as we work on that, that we would love to have your input today. If you have a question about the emerald ash borer, you know, for many of us, it's like, what does this beetle even look like? How do I identify it? How do I know if it's in an ash? And for that matter, how do I even identify an ash tree? Well, this is where to come. You can give us a call with your questions at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions on our webpage if you go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. And I want to tell you that we actually have a picture of the emerald ash borer beetle itself on our Facebook page. So if you want to get a look at this little beetle, I think it's actually fairly cute, kind of grasshopper-like in looks, a little shimmery, greenish. Go to facebook.com/Vermont Edition and you should be able to see a picture of that to have something in your head. And we're going to talk with Commissioner Snyder about exactly what this beetle looks like, what size it is, you know, how you identify it. But again, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or you can post your comments on our webpage at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Commissioner Snyder, let's see if we've got your microphone sorted out now. Are you there with us?
I can hear you.
Excellent. And I can hear you. Fantastic. So we are away. All right. So let me ask you first, Commissioner Snyder, if the emerald ash borer is already in New Hampshire, how can we be sure it's not in Vermont yet?
Well, it's a great question. It may very well be here, despite our best efforts to identify and locate it. We've had a systematic approach. People, I think your listeners probably are familiar with those odd paneled purple traps hanging in trees around the state, thousands of them.
Yeah, it's like little lanterns almost, those purple sort of triangular or square, I can't even remember now, but purple little tents in the trees.
Exactly. And that's part of a systematic effort that we have through a multi-agency kind of cooperative effort, Forest Parks and Recreation, the Agency of Agriculture, our friends at the U.S. Forest Service, University of Vermont, et cetera, in putting out this attempt to find it, to train citizen volunteers. Most infestations elsewhere, in fact, have been found by trained volunteers. So we've been setting out these traps to try to see if the insect is here, and none have showed up in any of our traps, in addition to training folks to look up and look out for this beetle and the effects it has on ash trees by teaching people what to look for in the trees. And if we found those symptoms, we would go look at those trees, and none of this has yet has resulted in us finding the beetle here in Vermont.
Tree Zero, as I've heard it called in the Concord area, though, in New Hampshire, the one that they found first, it was a citizen who was seeing a lot of woodpecker activity, which is a sign because woodpeckers love the larva of this beetle. But it looks like that tree, Tree Zero, had been infested for 3 or 4 years. So it's likely that the beetle has actually been in New Hampshire for several years. And it can travel very slowly on its own. But with, you know, people moving firewood and such, it's likely that it travels much faster. So we could still have that in Vermont happening, and we just haven't found it, right?
That's certainly true. And in fact, it does take a little bit of time for those kind of symptoms in the tree to show up, particularly the woodpecker damage, which is really the best way to see it. Up high in the crown, as you say, the woodpeckers like to eat those larvae underneath the bark. But it takes a while for the branch die back in the tops of the trees and the woodpecker damage to be really visible. So it's one of the problems is it could be here and evading our detection from those kind of visual signs.
You also say officials everywhere are saying, look, it's not a matter of if it gets here, but when. So do you have a timeline where you expect to start seeing signs of the emerald ash borer?
Not particularly. I mean, we've seen, as you indicate, it's all around us now. We're not completely surrounded by the beetle itself, but we're surrounded by states and provinces that have isolated, localized infestations. And it just stands to reason that it's coming. We don't have a particular time frame other than, you know, been working at this for a few years to try to train our staffs and the public to help us identify it and just to be ready for what to do when it's here. In a large measure, that's really about delaying it. We want to keep it out of Vermont as long as we can. And then once we do find it here, we want to delay its spread, all of which is intended to give us some time, buy us time for research, both sort of scientifically and management in terms of forest management strategies to help us create strategies to manage living with the beetle. As you indicated in the opening, that it's only been in this country just over 10 years. So it's all relatively new, and we need to, and it's non-native, and we need to figure out ways to adapt to it and respond accordingly. And by delaying its arrival and then its eventual spread, that does buy us some time to work out strategies, get the word out, and have a reasonable approach to how we can cope with it.
We got a note from Sean who says, and repeating here about the ash borer can't be stopped. It's only a matter of time before the insect sweeps in and changes Vermont's forests forever, Sean wrote. And then says, I read that approximately 10% of Vermont's trees are ash, and if this beetle comes to town, they may all be eaten. Is that still the prognosis? And is that right, 10% of our trees are ash?
Well, I'd say our best guesses are it's a little high. I'd say more like 5 or 6% of our trees we understand to be, based on our inventory data, systematic statewide assessment of what trees we have, how big, where, how many, what species. So, you know, maybe 5 or 6%. I suppose it could be as much as 10%. The beetle kills ash trees basically of all sizes. Any tissues really 1 inch or larger are vulnerable. And that's why we're so concerned. Ash is a native plant. It's not sugar maple, but it's a native and important part of our forest ecosystems. And equally important, and maybe a little less well understood, is it's more and more a really important part of our urban and suburban and community treescapes. It's a green ash in particular is really well suited to growing in urban environments that are very challenging. And so over the years, we've planted lots of those, and they're an important part of town greens, streetscapes, et cetera. So for the ecological, the social, and economic reasons, we don't want to lose all these ash trees. And so that's, again, why we want to slow it to give us some help in buying some time to develop strategies, both in terms of how should we respond when people have an infestation, and then hoping for biocontrol techniques, helping to find genetic resistance in our native populations, and that sort of thing.
We're talking today about the emerald ash borer beetle. It's been spotted in New Hampshire. As Commissioner Mike Snyder of the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation told us, we are now surrounded by states and provinces that have localized infestations of the emerald ash borer. It's a matter of time before the beetle gets to Vermont if it's not here already. And we're going to talk a little bit about what the state is trying to do to prevent widespread destruction, to slow the infestation, and what else is out there that scientists are working on to try to figure out maybe what could kill the beetle or what could protect the trees. But first, we're going to look a little bit more at how you identify this beetle, how you identify ash trees that might be infested. And if you have a question about that, you can post it at vpr.net, or again, you can call 1-800-639-2211. We have Mike, who's on the line from Peru. Hi, Mike. Go right ahead.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good, good. Well, I was just wondering about the life cycle of this little devil. And, it sounds like it attacks the top of the tree, whether it attacks the buds or whether it drills in and lays eggs and under the bark, or how exactly that all works. And sounded also like the best way of identifying it almost is looking at the crowns and looking for dieback there.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for the call. So first of all, Commissioner Snyder, the life cycle of the beetle.
Sure. And these are great questions, Mike. Thanks. It's the beetle. First, it's a bright metallic green, but it's very small, half inch long, maybe an eighth inch wide, kind of a flattened back, maybe a little bit bullet shaped. And that's the adult stage of the insect. And those are the ones interested in flying around, finding a mate, and then laying eggs. The eggs are laid in the bark of ash trees, and then the eggs hatch and a larval stage emerges that bores in through the bark into the vascular system, essentially just under the bark, kind of between the bark and the wood. And then that larval stage feeds, creating those S-shaped galleries underneath the bark and interrupting the vascular system. Then they would do that from maybe the adults would emerge, fly around, look for mates, lay their eggs. All that would happen during the spring, May through July, August, somewhere in there, and maybe up until September. And then they would overwinter, and then the adult again would emerge through what we call D-shaped exit holes in the stems and branches of ash trees the following year. It's generally a one-year cycle, but new research is indicating that in certain environments, it may be a two-year cycle. But that's generally it. There's an adult flying around looking for a mate. They can feed on leaves, but that's not their main problem from this insect. It's really the borer that does the damage is the larval stage that's occurring under the bark.
Can you explain, Commissioner Snyder, how they actually travel? I mentioned that they travel very slowly on their own, but do the beetles fly? Do they have to walk? And then they actually get transported, which is how they travel so quickly over wide distances.
Exactly. The adult, the green flying beetle, is what it can fly, and maybe a half mile to a mile a year. When they're in a suitable habitat, the larval stage that does most of the damage in the tree, it doesn't really move from tree to tree. It does its thing in the tree. The problem there is when ash are really valuable for lots of wood products, flooring and firewood and furniture. And when wood products, ash is moved with the borer in it, it can go from moving, whereas the adult only travels maybe a half a mile or a mile per year, the larva can travel 65 miles an hour. And that's a big difference.
Let's go to Richard, who's calling in from Walcott. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. I was curious about whether plants related to the ash, like lilacs and forsythia and privet, all that sort of thing, whether they're susceptible to this beetle or whether they're kind of immune.
Thanks for the call, Richard. What do you think, Commissioner Snyder?
We understand that the ash, emerald ash borer, attacks all species of ash. So that's the genus Fraxinus, all the species. So white ash in Vermont would be white ash, black ash, green ash, but not mountain ash, which is not a true ash, and not box elder that looks a lot like ash, and not those closely related in the same family species mentioned like lilacs. So it's really just the true ash species.
And can you explain a little bit more? I mentioned that it girds the tree. It sort of burrows in, the larva does. But can you explain how it kills ash trees?
Yep, that's exactly how it kills them. The larvae looking for something to eat. And girdling is the general term we use for interrupting the vascular system. Folks might remember these scary words from high school biology, xylem and phloem. Those are the tissues just under the bark that take nutrient and water from the soil up into the plant and carbohydrates from the leaves down through the growing tissues of the tree. So those are that's the plumbing system within the tree, that, and it's just under the bark, and it's vital to the life of the tree, and this beetle destroys it, and that's why it kills the tree, because it can't live without that plumbing system intact and functioning.
How long does that take once the beetle's there? How long before it kills a tree?
Depending on the pre-existing condition of the tree, it can be a year or two to maybe up to 5 or 6 years. It can take a while for the tree. And remember, trees are really tough, and they will try to hang in there, and they're highly resilient in a lot of ways. But when there's it can vary, a couple years to maybe 5 or 6 years.
And does it kill every tree that it infests? Have we seen any kind of resistance in ash trees in the U.S.?
We have. In other states with heavy infestations, there's still maybe a percent or two of the ash trees that remain uninfested, which, as you suggest, is a really hopeful sign that, well, why? Why are they there? There's the insect infestation all around, and this tree is hanging in there. That suggests that the tree has some level of resistance. We hope that can be genetically conferred, that enables the tree to be even more resilient against these kind of attacks.
Commissioner Snyder, what does the beetle live off of in Asia, where it's native, eastern Russia, northern China, Japan, Korea? I mean, presumably, if it's a native species there, it lives off something, but it's not killing all of those trees.
Great question. And my understanding is that it does kill trees in its native land and by the same mechanism. But one of the forms of resistance is that the trees there have co-evolved. They've evolved with this borer, and there are other organisms, fungi, bacteria, insects that may prey upon various life stages of the emerald ash borer. And there could be sort of chemical responses in the tree that allow it to kind of wall it off or fight it off or resist it somehow inside. So it's a damaging agent there in Asia, but those trees have evolved with it and thereby have some kind of mechanism to withstand it and not be completely eradicated. And that's the problem here, is we lack those natural controls, be they predators or, you know, sort of physiological resistances.
Well, in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about what possibilities there are to maybe import some people, or not people rather, but animals that could actually combat the beetle. But while we're still talking about what this beetle is, how it works, let's go to Sonia, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Sonia, go ahead.
Hi. I understand that this type of beetle is from Asia, from China.
Mm-hmm.
So how did it get here in North America?
Sonia, thanks for the call. Commissioner Snyder?
Our best understanding is it arrived in the Detroit area in 2002 via hardwood packing material. You know, with increased globalization, there's transport of goods and things back and forth more and more, and wood is used as packing materials. And as we said earlier, the larval stage can hitch a ride on that packing material safely make the trip. And then in industrial areas where it's unloaded, it then emerges and flies around and does its thing here. And that's our best understanding, is that it arrived through hardwood packing material.
We're talking today about the emerald ash borer beetle. It is responsible for the demise of tens of millions of ash trees in the U.S. alone. And it looks like it is headed here. We're surrounded by it. So we're talking today with Mike Snyder, the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, to find out, what is this beetle? How does it work? How does it kill the trees? And coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about what scientists and researchers are trying to do to prevent or slow the spread of the beetle, and what landowners, woodlot owners in Vermont are thinking about this. We got a note from Timothy in Waltham who says, as a maker of Windsor chairs, ash is my wood of choice for spindles, legs, and stretchers. Ash is long-grained, and it makes a spindle that can be long and thin and very strong while being quite flexible. There is no substitute that can compare in strength, grain quality, and availability to ash. This will definitely have a financial impact on my business. So more about that kind of effect that the emerald ash borer might have on Vermont coming up. If you have thoughts on that, want to share your own questions, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with Michael Snyder, Commissioner of the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation for Vermont, and he's sharing with us some of the concerns Vermont officials have about the emerald ash borer beetle, which appears to be on its way to the state. It was just found in New Hampshire earlier this month. We've been talking a little bit about what the beetle looks like, how it actually kills ash trees, and we're going to talk now about the economic impact an infestation could have on Vermont and how researchers and scientists are working to try to slow the spread, perhaps find something that can combat the beetle. And if you have questions about that, about Vermont's strategy, or want to talk to us about what this might mean for your business, for the economics that you're thinking of, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, where you will also see a picture of the emerald ash borer beetle, so you have an idea of what you're looking out for here. Just before the break, I read an email from Tim, a furniture maker, and I think he's on the line with us now. Tim in Plainfield, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Tim.
I just wanted to say that there definitely will be an economic impact for me. Ash is really the best wood for my Windsor chairs. There are other woods that may work, but it's just wood to work with, and I'm definitely nervous about what that will mean for my business. I make all different kinds of furniture, but Windsor chairs are my specialty. And
so, Tim, are you going to be buying up ash now by the truckful?
Really have a way to stockpile it. I've thought about that. I would love to do that. I'd love to have a barn where I could buy a whole bunch to last me the next 20 years. But it's easier said than done.
Yeah, well, Tim, thank you for calling and really putting a fine point on what this might mean for people's businesses, for the economic picture. Commissioner Snyder, what else? You know, Tim's a furniture maker. What else are we looking at that could be an impact of the emerald ash borer coming to Vermont?
Well, as you said, and Tim's pointed out well, that ash is an amazing wood. It's used for all kinds of things. He referenced quite accurately its many qualities and properties that make it desirable for a lot of different uses. And many people like Tim depend on it as a supply for what they do, craftsmen and beyond. And then there's the ecological value. It's part of our native forest types. It plays an important role as feed and home habitat for wildlife. I mentioned earlier its value is in street trees. So it's just, there's an economic, a very important economic consideration, as well as an ecologic and a social implication here. So we're deeply concerned about it. We have some 150 million ash trees in the state, and our strategies are about, as I said, slowing it so that we can buy some time so that we can keep ash as a component of our forest. It may change, but we are hopeful that through buying time so that we can help people understand how to manage their woods with this specter in mind, and also give us a chance to maybe have some of these biocontrols that can stem the tide, that we can keep ash present and folks like Tim can continue to use ash wood. That's our goal.
Well, and to that end, you're asking woodlot owners not to just chop down all of their ash, which might make sense from an economic standpoint. I mean, at least you could still get some money for your timber before it's riddled with emerald ash borer holes. Why shouldn't woodlot owners chop all their wood down, given the fact that right now we don't know of any effective way to stop the spread?
Right. And we also don't know exactly what's going to happen. So cutting down all the ash now, preemptively, may be worse than the emerald ash borer. Because cutting them down and doing so indiscriminately without a plan for regenerating ash and other native species will be sure to end our times with ash. So that's step one, is don't panic. We don't want to flood. There's also marketplace considerations. We don't want to flood the market and depress prices and then have a glut followed by a shortage. So our advice, and we've got good advice, written advice for land managers, landowners. These can all be found at our website, vtfpr.org. Very simple documents explaining this sort of thing. We have county foresters throughout the state available to meet one-on-one with landowners to help them create a customized plan for how to approach their woods and their ash trees. the general idea is, sure, it's reasonable to think that if you've got some ash trees that are kind of nearing the end of their time and you're planning a timber harvest in your woods anyway, it's reasonable to work with your foresters to think about, well, should some of these that are at higher risk, maybe we'll make use, recover some of our economic value there in those trees now, but not all your ash trees, particularly healthy ash trees. And you want to do the cutting in such a way that considers how might we best time the event and the intensity of the harvesting so as to encourage the regeneration of new ash trees so we have some future forest on the way. And, you know, as I say, I think we've got some pretty good written documents, and there's no substitute for getting out there in the woods. In your woods, yours are different than the next person's, and your goals may be different. So that's why we have foresters available to help people make these decisions.
Let's go to Bruce, who's calling in from Castleton. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks, Jane, for taking my call. I have a question about my woodlot, which is in Castleton, and we purchased it about 8 or 9 years ago. And the forester came in, and he looked at it, and I have some beautiful ash trees, which have very poor tops and these little sprout things that you mentioned. And he called it ash decline, which he seemed to think was a fungus. But other than that, he knew nothing about it, and he told me that eventually probably most of my ash would die, which is approximately, well, a solid 10% of my woodlot. I was wondering if there was any kind of relationship or if this beetle appears that that my trees are doomed.
Regardless. Yeah. Bruce, let's give that to Commissioner Snyder. You know, Bruce got word that his ash is already declining.
Right. And this is really where this is important, and it's where it gets a little bit tricky, is that there, and it's great that we have a chance to talk about this, that there are other problems in ash trees. All of our trees, all healthy forests have some level of dead trees and dying trees. It's a question of when that gets out of balance that is no longer a healthy forest. So we have native issues with our trees. And indeed, ash trees have some things going on with them beyond EAB. There's this this general malaise or ash decline, which we see as dieback in the trees. That may be that ash is well known, notorious even, for not doing well under drought and on shallow soils that have fluctuating water tables. So we want to look at those carefully, and we've seen an increasing number of ash trees with dieback unrelated to EAB. Then there's this ash yellows, which is a microscopic organism. It's poorly understood, but it's a disease, an infectious disease that also infects ash trees. And so they can have similar symptoms visually in terms of dieback. And that's why this issue of the woodpeckers is so helpful, because if you see those bright patches where and it's not big cavities excavated that we normally associate with woodpeckers, it's more scraping of the bark as it tries to find those larvae underneath the bark. Those are really telltale, because there's no reason for a woodpecker to do that on a tree that has drought problems or on a tree that has this pathogen in it. The woodpeckers are pretty darn smart, and they're looking for a tree that has larvae underneath that they can make a meal out of.
Well, we actually got a note or spoke yesterday with Chris Melendi, who works for the A. Johnson Lumber Company in Bristol, and he said his company is actually harvesting all of their ash trees because they're worried about that fungus, Vermont yellow, they call it. And so in order to make sure they can get some money for that timber, they are harvesting their ash now. We've got a couple minutes left, Commissioner Snyder, and I want to ask you to tick through some of the things that researchers are working on. You know, we've heard about wasps that are being imported, that maybe they can attack the beetles, slow the decline of the ash. What's going on here that researchers are working on to try to make sure that not all of our ash are killed by the ash borer?
Sure. A couple of the parasitic wasp is maybe the best hope. The idea is simply to think, well, where it came from in Asia, does it have things that keep it in check, its populations in check? Because that's one of the problems, is that it could be manageable if it's a reasonable population of insects, but if it explodes because it has nothing to control it, then it gets really out of control. So looking to Asia to say what naturally preys on this there. One of them is a wasp that has been imported here in trials, not yet in Vermont, but other states are trying it. That's a tricky situation when you don't want the cure to be worse than the disease, if you will. So we don't want the wasp to get out of control and have unintended consequences on other insects or organisms here. So under controlled situations, trying to bring that wasp. There's also some hope that there's a bacterium, I believe, that can infect emerald ash borers and kill them to keep their populations in check. And then again, there are management strategies to, and one thing that we do know from other states is going out in infested areas and cutting all the ash trees around it has failed miserably. So we do not plan to do that in Vermont, where we would just, once we do find it here, we're not going to go out and plan to eradicate all the ash trees in a ring around the infestation in some kind of an attempt to keep it from spreading, because that's proven to fail miserably elsewhere. And the result is you just lose more ash trees.
What about specifically in Vermont? What are you working on in terms of making sure that people at least know how to be on the lookout, know what to do if they think they suspect ash borer?
This is public involvement, getting people, spreading the word on what it is, what the problem is. And so that's step one. We're doing, we have a first detectors program, training landowners to see and help other people to look out for this, and then getting the word out about getting advice, getting guidance from trained foresters who can help you react accordingly. Those are the basic fundamentals, and I would encourage people to look at vtinvasives.org. It's a tremendous website of multiple partners putting all this information and making it easily available to folks.
And we'll put that up at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. We'll also put the earlier link that you mentioned, ways for people to get involved, ways for people to identify ash borer or ash trees in the first place. Michael Snyder is commissioner of the Vermont Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. He's been telling us a little bit about the emerald ash borer, how to identify it, and how it might affect Vermont when it comes here. Commissioner Snyder, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks, Jane, and look up, Vermont.
Yes, that's the first step. Look up, see what you can see, and then tell someone. Coming up, we'll learn more about what the departure of Anya Rader Wallach from the Green Mountain Care Board means for health care reform efforts in the state. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont's effort to transform its healthcare system into a single-payer model is guided by the Green Mountain Care Board, the 5-member panel charged with containing costs and redesigning healthcare payment and delivery systems. But there was a surprising hiccup last month when the chair of that board announced she's resigning at the end of this summer. Anya Rader Wallach has been seen as key to the healthcare changes that Governor Peter Shumlin has been pushing. I'm joined now by VPR News analyst Hamilton Davis to learn what her departure means for healthcare reform in Vermont. Hello, Ham.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So first, why don't you start by telling us what background Anya Rader Wallach has that has made her so important to the governor's plan for healthcare reform?
Well, Jane, there are really three things. I think she has a PhD in this, and more important than that, I think, or at least equally important, is the fact that she's had tremendous experience. She ran Howard Dean's effort at healthcare reform in the 1990s. At the same time, she was a member of Hillary Clinton's national healthcare reform effort. Both of those failed, of course, but if that's the test, then nobody's qualified, because all healthcare reform efforts in the United States have failed so far. So there's a lot of experience here, both nationally and statewide, as far as Anya was concerned. She knows Vermont inside and out. And the final thing I think that makes her particularly important, she is very, very good at Vermont politics. She grew up here. She went to college here. She's run political campaigns here. If she was not a healthcare expert, she might be a political expert. So these three, having all of these three things together, quite unusual. And gave her a terrific start on this program.
And what steps have been taken since she started leading the effort, and what still remains to be done after she's departed?
Well, the steps that are in place are mainly building the infrastructure to make the thing go. You have the exchange, which goes into effect next January. Vermont is ahead of most of the rest of the country on that. The regulatory apparatus, which consists of the Green Mountain Care Board itself, is also in place. And the Green Mountain Care Board also has machinery being built now to deal with the questions that lie right at the heart of healthcare reform, which is how can you reorganize the system and change the payment mechanisms so that you can get genuine efficiency inside the delivery system itself? If you don't have that, then it's going to be very hard to get healthcare reform in the end.
Well, you wrote recently for VPR.net that the departure of Anya Rader Wallach is a blow. but not a crippling blow to healthcare reform in Vermont. So parse that for us.
Well, I think that you cannot gainsay losing somebody with this suite of skills, if you will. The question is whether what's left or what can be put in place makes up for that loss. And I think that Shumlin, who got lucky in getting Anya Rader Wallach in the first place, got lucky again when he found Al Gobay, a Chittenden County business person, to be on the Green Mountain Care Board. And it just turns out that that has worked very well. Even after Anya Rader Wallach leaves, okay, Al Gobay, who will be the new chair and who is an expert at business, and hospitals are businesses before they're anything else. He also has very good leadership skills. He's firm in an easygoing way. For example, when the question became how to set the target for the hospital budgets, the drafts were always written by Al. And so I think he's very good at that. The second aspect of that, Jane, is that for the past 40 years, the real great difficulty in managing healthcare costs in the United States, if the hospitals and doctors said, we just need this money to make people better, then you just had to come up with the money. And that's what got us where we are. The board is lucky, I think, in the sense that not only do they have Gobay on the business side, but they have Dr. Alan Ramsey on the medical side, the toughest guy out there on saying that there's plenty of money in the system, that the medical community has a moral obligation to get this thing fixed, that the biggest problem is not that it doesn't have enough money, but that it is not committed to getting the money solved, has been Alan Ramsey. And so those two things, to me, justify optimism about getting it done.
So you've got Al Gobay, who's been on the board and will now take over as the chair with Anya Rader Wallach's departure. You've got, as you mentioned, Dr. Alan Ramsey, who can come at it from the medical side. But you mentioned that Rader Wallach had a unique suite of skills, which it doesn't sound like the others have. So is there anyone who has similar policy experience that could be put in Rader Wallach's place on the board as she departs?
It's not impossible, and that could happen. There's been no discussion, and nobody will discuss it. I've tried. I think they will retain Wallach as a consultant. What that will do is at least should go partway to making up for any lack of really deep knowledge of healthcare policy generally. I think that's what they'll do.
What about the other two members of the board, Con Hogan and Dr. Karen Hine? What do they bring to the table?
Well, they've done very important work. I mean, Con Hogan is very interested in issues like community needs. What is the community needs? And they're trying to figure that out. Karen Hine, who's got long experience in academic medicine, is very interested in trying to tease out how these systems work, how they deal with change. Those things are important. But to me, and this is my opinion, is that big test is whether you can get health care costs under control, because I think that if you can't, you can't get health care reform no matter what else you do.
So in that vein, what are you going to be looking for as the next steps the board takes as we move into the future and continue this work on health policy reform?
I think it's fairly clear what the real questions are. And what were the big tests ahead are, I think, the first is that the Green Mountain Care Board has to get hospital budgets by this summer that show evidence that there is a real movement toward healthcare cost containment and that the hospitals have bought into the idea they really have to change the way they do business. That's the first big step. The second big step is that the exchange has to go well. The preliminary work on the exchange has been excellent. It's as good as anything else in the United States. Many states, probably more than half, have got no exchange at all. And Vermont was moving on the exchange from day one. So the first test is the budgets. The second test is the exchange has to work well. The biggest test of all for the machinery is whether you can reorganize the system so that it works efficiently and so that you can change the payment mechanism. If all regulation can really do is slow down the rate of increase each year. And that's no small thing. That's never been done before. But even then, that doesn't mean that the system is efficient. The real question is, can you rebuild it and reorganize it so that it works efficiently, really efficiently, so that you might even save money, so that you can maintain sustainable costs out year after year after year? That is the central test. And then the final one, Jane, out there in the future, probably no closer than 3 to 5 years, is will the public buy it? Will the public agree to pay for it? Will you be able to fund the system? And no one in this world can predict whether that will happen.
Hamilton Davis is a longtime journalist and news analyst. You can read his analysis of healthcare reform efforts in Vermont at vpr.net. Ham, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For middle school students, spelling bees have become a high-stress activity. The National Spelling Championships are now televised, and the winner gets a $30,000 cash prize. It's a lot more relaxed for the competitors in Spellcheck, Brattleboro's spelling bee for grown-ups, and a lot less lucrative. The big prize for the winners of Spellcheck? Their names on the marquee of the Latches Theater. But contestants keep signing up. VPR's Susan Keese gives us a recap from this month's fifth annual Spellcheck.
The idea of a spelling bee for grown-ups was conceived as a way to raise money to help restore the old Art Deco Latches Theater. A Latches trustee said she'd always wanted to compete in a spelling bee.
So we thought about it.
Gail Nunziata is the managing director of Latches Arts.
And we got a bunch of people together, including Tom Baudet, and it just sort of took off.
Baudet, a public radio personality who lives in Dummerston, agreed to be the Spelling Bee's MC as long as it was fun. And it has been, judging from the crowd streaming into the theater for this year's Spellcheck. 18 teams of 3 people each have signed up for the competition. Some come in costume. Mike Moricki, a state legislator from Putney, is here as Groucho Marx. He wiggles a pair of fake eyebrows and taps an unlit cigar.
Say the magic word and split $100.
Maricki's teammates are his daughter Grace, dressed as Chico Marx, and Amelia Struthers as Harpo. The team is called the Sesquipedalians, which means lovers of big words. The reigning champs from last year are the B-52s, named after a 70s rock group. The women on the team all have massive beehive hairdos. A team from the New England Youth Theater is called To Be or Not to Be. There's a group of teachers from the local high school and a trio of lawyers who say they've done their homework.
Oh, man, we've been spending months briefing this.
Moderator Tom Baudet collects interesting words for this event all year. Words like lissotricus, having straight or smooth hair, ophiophagus, feeding on snakes, and prognathus, having a jaw that protrudes outward.
And then I'll sit down as we get closer to it and start putting them in some kind of an order so that I can make a bit of a story out of it.
Baudet has to use each word in a sentence during the competition. The bee is set up like a game show. 3 teams seated at tables are on stage at once. Also on stage, opposite Baudet, is lawyer Jim Maxwell, a.k.a. the beekeeper. Baudet says the word and Maxwell defines it. Then Baudet gives a sentence.
The word is hyamal.
Hyamal, of or relating to winter.
With the weekend free of anything even remotely hyamal, the farm store parking lots were crammed with Volvos, Subarus, and even the occasional pickup truck.
The word is hyamal. Begin.
The teams have 15 seconds to spell the word on a whiteboard and hold it up.
Time.
Oh, sorry.
Brattleboro town manager Barb Sondag is this year's judge.
Way to go!
When 2 of the teams on stage are eliminated, another 3 teams go up, followed by another 3, until all 18 teams have had their turn. Winning teams go on to the semifinals and eventually to the finals. The contest this year was decided by the word hebdomad.
Hebdomad, a group of 7.
Arnold eyed the hebdomad of Ernest Gardeners ahead of him in line and thought, Geez, some crow, this is going to take all day.
The word is hebdomad. Begin.
And we have a new champion.
The winner is a group called the Three Bells of Kids Place, after an indoor play space in town.
The Three Bells of Kids Place.
One of the bells, the captain, is a man, Kira Storm. He says he saw the evening as a chance to put on a skirt and have some fun. On further questioning, Storm acknowledges that he's also a tournament Scrabble player. And though it was fun, he was in it to win. For VPR News, I'm Susan Keese.
And that will do it for today's show. Tomorrow on the program, how locavore are we? And you can spell that if you want. A new index places Vermont at the top of the heap when ranking states on their local food efforts. Per capita, we lead the way in farmers markets, CSAs, and food hubs. On the program, we're going to look at where Vermont is excelling and where there's room for improvement. And you can send your thoughts or questions about Vermont's locavore efforts to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.